Okay, I'll leave that. If there are any comments about that, we can go back to that maybe in a minute. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
In Kama Sutra, how does the soul stop being rebirth, or how does one start up?
It's a very good question, big question. Again, we would generally in Buddhist community not use the word soul at all. Yeah, so it's difficult. What do we use? Mind, heart, jitta, so on, you know, because the Western way of talking is very dualistic. You know, you've got heart and mind, and jitta means like both, really, heart and mind. But really the only way you can get some kind of insight into that as a direct understanding is through meditation. And when you begin to see, you know, okay, we call it the soul just for sake of argument. What right now, in this present moment, is your soul? Where is it? What is it? What's the relationship between what you call your soul and your body? Okay, if you were to kill somebody, which is a physical action, would that have any effect on your soul, which is non-physical? What's the process, what's the mechanism by which a physical action can affect something non-physical? What is this thing, you know, that we call soul, we call me? This is really what we're moving towards in meditation. We're doing this sort of basic, like learning the keys of a piano with the sort of meditation techniques to begin with. But what you're ultimately looking for, you want to be able to develop your mind to have that kind of sharpness and clarity to be really able to investigate, what is this? You know, who am I? What's all this about? And so the question is, well, what happens to the soul after death? What these are all based on a premise that there is this thing called a soul. And so Buddhism says, is there? Is there really? Where is it? Show it to me. What is it? You know, is there anything you can really say is you? You say, okay, what kind of person are you? You say, well, I got a lot of anger. Okay, show me your anger. Get angry for me right now. Well, you can't, because the causes and conditions are not there for anger. So is there anything you can really say, this is mine, this is who I am, this is really me, this is what distinguishes me from everybody else? You know, where is it? Show it to me. Is it under your control? These are the kind of questions that you approach in your own experience, moment by moment and day by day. And it's through that experience and looking closely at yourself right now that you can start to understand these teachings about rebirth and so on, and what passes on and what doesn't. So having said all that, simple question is that this process of rebirth carries on and on. It's not some kind of new age teachings of this idea, sort of you're going up, you know, everything's basically all right, you know, and then you get finally, after all these trials and tribulations, you reach to the top. But in Buddhism, it can just go on forever and ever and ever and ever until you eradicate the causes or the fuel of the fire, and the fuel of the fire is greed, hatred, and delusion. So that's the only way that you can transcend this. So even it's noticeable in the Buddhist teachings that the whole questions of time and distance are very, very modern, we would say. I mean, the Buddha's talking about solar systems and universes and millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of miles. And talking about, there's one point where the Buddha says through his meditation he saw the world just like a makam bomb. You know, it's just this, like a little green fruit. In terms of time and eons, there are all kinds of incredible similes to explain Buddhist idea of time. They say it's this huge mountain, say 15 kilometers long, 15 kilometers wide, made of iron, or made, and then once every million years, a bird comes along and just brushes the top of the mountain with its wing. And the time for that whole mountain to wear away, you know, is like one eon or one gap. So Buddha had this conception of time, which is, I don't think anywhere it was found anywhere else in the world in the past. I mean, even to this day, 50% of Americans believe the world is only 7,000 years old. It's incredible to believe. But so, you know, as far as what the Big Bang, and you know, is concerned, you know, what do we think about the Big Bang? Yeah, we can accept Big Bang theory in Buddhism, but we think that there have been millions of Big Bangs, you know, and there'll be more Big Bangs. It just goes on. There's a process of arising, sustaining, and passing away. But the time scale is just, you know, just unthinkably huge. So this life is just one tiny, tiny, like, particle within that. But there is a way out, as I say, is the path of practice to freedom from the sense of self and through power of greed, hatred, and delusion. The, like, heaven and hell are like impermanent states. So it's not, there's not an idea like in say Christianity of eternal heaven and eternal hell. And also there is rebirth into animal realms. You just look at compare the number of human beings to the number of ants, for instance. So a number of human beings increasing in this particular world, there may be human beings, people from other realms taking rebirth in this human realm, or many animals. I think as human beings get coarser, you know, just think of more kind of animals and lower life forms taking birth as human beings these days, isn't it? Okay, that's another question here. The majority of the people before you are young people coming from wealthy families. Could you agree that there are very poor families that need this education more than us from Buddhist temples, but are more likely to be turned down because they have nothing to offer in return? In brackets, since not all Buddhist temples are good in that sense. Today, is Buddhism in Thailand a set of faith here that is catered towards the rich? I wouldn't say that at all, really. Again, I can only speak from my personal experience. I've been in Thailand now for, 28 years, and the vast majority of that I've spent in forest monasteries in northeast Thailand, where the vast majority of the people who come to the monastery every day are rice farmers and families, and some people from the local towns and surrounding villages and from the city. And at least in my experience, the forest monasteries, particularly in the northeast of Thailand, do a wonderful job of providing Buddhist teachings to the local people. For instance, in some of you will have been to Wat Bapong or Wat Bananachat, but Wat Bananachat, where I was the abbot for many years, we have a very close relationship with the local villages around the monastery. And still on the One Prat day, there will be many people who will come and spend the whole day and the whole night in the monastery. So on the One Prat morning, they'll come about 7 or 8 in the morning, and they'll do the morning chanting, and then they offer food. And then the ones that are retired and not still working will spend the day in the monastery reading, meditating, studying, maybe doing a bit of sweeping, or it depends what they want to do. And then in the evening, the people who've been to work will come back, and then they spend the whole night in the monastery. And there's evening chanting and meditation. And then when I was there, I used to give every One Prat, I would give a talk, usually from 10 o'clock at night till midnight. 10 o'clock to 11:30 would be like a formal talk, and then for a half an hour I just talk with the village people more generally. I do that once a week for years and years and years, and then stay on through the night, and four in the morning we do the morning chanting, 5 in the morning, people would go, most of them would just go back to work after having been up all night. Many of them sitting, some of the village people, they can sit still without moving from 10 at night till 4 and 5 in the morning. So amongst the villagers in northeast Thailand, particularly those that are that live close to forest monasteries, they get very good teaching. But of course, you know, you can't force people to go to monasteries, and with the changes in society and then the younger generation not going to the monasteries as much as they used to, although again it's changing once more now. I think that, I don't know with other monks, I'm not particularly, you know, interested like who's wealthy, who's not wealthy. I mean, it's more interest that's... But I would say that I think that, you know, there are so many ways in which the life of the poor people in this country have been disturbed, and so much suffering have been caused to poor people through the actions of wealthy people, many of whom have got very good educations in the West, but have lacked any clear understanding of Buddhism and their own religion and their own culture. And so have come back from the West with their degrees and their doctorates, and have gone into positions of authority, and have been able to guide the country's social economic development in ways which have been, from my point of view, quite unwise. And you can just see the amount of corruption and the difficulties in the country at the moment. And these are not, I would suggest, difficulties created by poor people. They're created by people with what we call a good education, people from wealthy families. So I do feel I am interested in providing some perspective, some information, some inspiration for people like yourself who come from wealthy families and are, you say, in the elite of this country, with the hope that not only will it be of benefit to all of you in your lives, but that benefit will, to use modern phrase, trickle down to everyone else in the country. Because if people in government, people in business, people in the academic world have a thorough grounding in Buddhist training, not the ceremonies and the externals and, you know, sort of knowing how to do everything so it looks good, but actually getting into the heart of the teachings and applying them, then I think it will be of great benefit for this whole country. So yeah, I do see the value of this kind of occasion and this kind of retreat. And I don't think also it's a matter of choosing between, you know, teaching this group or teaching that group. The idea is hopefully that there is enough teaching to go around for everyone. Certainly all the books and tapes, CDs that are produced by Wat Bapong of Ajahn Chah, most of the forest teachers, books and tapes of my own teachings, these are all produced for free and sent off to anybody who, wherever they are. Somebody's only going to write a letter if they're living in the countryside, and say, and send them a big box full, as many as they want. So I certainly have that ideal of sharing the Dhamma freely and for everyone, without you know, having to have a certain income or being able to afford a certain amount of you know, to be a donations. I'm not interested in donations at all. I like to have donations because I give them away as soon as I get them. I know a lot of very poor monasteries. I've got a lot of very good friends who are living in very backward areas of Thailand, and some of them are building salas, building toilets, They want to hold retreats, they want to do things, and they don't have any funding. So if I get donations here, then I can send it off to them. So I'm more of a conduit or a channel to for monks who, you know, don't have the opportunity to meet with the more wealthy sections of society. Okay, that's another question. Another question about women again. What is the difference between a Meiji and a female monk's role in Buddhism? A female monk we call a bhikkhuni. Okay, so as a bhikkhu or a bhikkhu and bhikkhuni or bhikkhuni. As I mentioned briefly yesterday, when Theravada Buddhism became established in Thailand, in the time in the Sukhothai period, the Meiji order had already died out. The Bhikkhuni order had already died out in India. So the Theravada Buddhism, when it first flourished in Thailand, was one led by the monks. Now, after some time, this Meiji order was developed, but they weren't like ordained nuns or bhikkhunis, but they're like lay nuns, if you like. And there were certain rules that, certainly in the Ayutthaya period, a woman had to be over 40 before she could become a Meiji, because they didn't want to have young nuns and young monks living too close together for obvious reasons. Now that, over the course of time, changed, but the image of the Meiji in Thailand never really sort of recovered from this idea that it's a place where old women go when they don't have family to look after them, where they can spend last years of their life being looked after. So the monastery has always been sort of the social security safety net for people in this country. So a woman who's abandoned, her husband died, no kids, rather than become destitute, would go and live in a monastery. And the monks would share their alms food with them, and maybe she'd grow some vegetables and so on, do some cooking in the monastery. And so this is the image of the Meiji that developed. And then you've got the second sort of strand, the sort of the young woman with the broken heart who wants to forget all about men and become a nun, you see. So these are the sort of the two stereotypes of the nun, the old lady who sort of wants to spend the last years of her life doing something good, and the young, broken-hearted woman. And this is, unfortunately, you know, this image is kind of stuck to Meiji's. And you know, there are some very inspiring Meiji's in the country, particularly in the forest monasteries in northeast Thailand. And also there are Meiji's who put a lot of effort into trying to develop this institution to be something a little bit more inspiring and worthy of respect. And Meiji Kunyin Kanita, figure in that. And then these days in Bangkok, there's Meiji Sansani, which many of you will have heard of. So there are some very capable, dedicated nuns who are trying to develop a nun's training, a Meiji's training, which will approximate or be similar in the quality or even higher quality perhaps than the monks. But the, as I say, you know, there is this problem of perception. I think need to have some people, some marketing people, do some kind of a rebranding of the Meiji. the Meiji brand, I think that, but I don't think it's that it's that feasible, really. The big Sunni orders really flourished in China, and then after the communist takeover in Taiwan. So if you really want to see like a flourishing, strong nun's order, you go to Taiwan. And there, actually, the bhikkhunis are probably more inspiring, stronger than the monk's order in Taiwan, or at least on equal footing. Certainly, given the respect of the Taiwanese people, equally with the monks. There, being the Mahayana tradition, there is a lot more kind of the idea of the monastic, and particularly the nun as someone involved in social welfare projects. So the nun, there are some meditation monasteries, but the nuns tend to be very active in social welfare and social relief projects. But the monastic order is generally very kind of wide, and it's kind of very flexible. You know, whether as a monk or as a nun, certainly as a monk, you know, within certain basic boundaries. You know, some monks want to go off and live in solitude and meditate, they can do that. And other monks want to study, monks want to teach, monks want to be involved more in social projects. There are probably opportunities for it throughout the country. The monastic order is... it's very large, and it's very, there's just so many different kinds of monasteries and so many different kinds of monks. Particularly once you get out of Bangkok and into the countryside, then there are some very inspiring things going on. And the question... what is meant by nirvana? And there's a joke in brackets, no, not the band. I wouldn't have thought the band anyway, because that band arose and passed away after I became a monk, so they don't really mean anything to me. Nirvana is the Sanskrit version of the Pali Nibbana. You remember yesterday I said in English, peas are bees and peas and bees are peas. So what in Thai we pronounce as nipan. Then in the alternative pronunciation it's nibbana, or the Sanskrit version nirvana. And nibbana basically means the extinction of greed, hatred, and delusion. So, to repeat, it's not like a place you go to, like a heaven realm. It refers to the complete absence of greed, hatred, and delusion, suffering, and the cause of suffering. So, say a fully enlightened being, an arahant, he's experiencing nibbana. So there is the experience of nibbana while you're still alive. And then once you die, your body passes away, there's the nibbana without body, without anything. And then it's just beyond language, you can't talk about it anymore. Because if it was something that you could explain or frame in words, then it wouldn't obviously be nibbana. Okay, that's the end of... there is another question in Thai, which I'll probably leave for the session this afternoon.
I go to a Christian university, so when my friends talk about suffering and how it builds their character and makes them stronger, and when I say Buddhism, when you're I don't really know the terms to use, but I say to them that, oh, we become like free from suffering, and they say, then how does is, I don't know how to explain it, but it's contradicting to their belief of how when they're suffering, like, and they believe in God, and they out of it they'll become stronger, and
shall I answer in English or in Thai? English, okay. Again, this is a confusion of terms. The word dukkha in Bali or in Thai is not referring just to this kind of difficulties in life. You know, okay, I mean, everyone's obviously going to agree that if you face difficulties in life, that you learn from them, that they're teachers, and this is common to all traditions. I think that, speaking, someone brought up in the West, in one of the criticisms of Christianity that you hear a lot amongst non-Christians is that there's this kind of glorification of suffering, that suffering is good in itself, and that somehow if you're not suffering, you know, you feel guilty because you're not suffering. So if you should be suffering, and so I think that as Buddhists we don't agree that, you know, suffering has a positive value in itself, you know, as suffering, but certainly in the practice, spiritual practice, then learning from suffering, understanding suffering, is very important. Yesterday I spoke about the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth of dukkha, I think it's better not to translate this word, because even to call it tuk and people misunderstand. So say dukkha, which is the Pali, and then its cause and the ending of dukkha and the path towards the ending of dukkha. Now, I said another way of talking about that is to say a lack of true happiness, and there's a cause for that, and there is the possibility, the existence of true happiness, and there is a path towards it. Now, the Buddha, in his very first teaching, his first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, said that there are the correct practices with regard to these four truths. And so the first noble truth of dukkha, or suffering if you like, is it is something to be understood. And the second noble truth, the cause, is to be abandoned. And the third, the cessation of suffering, is to be realized. And the fourth, the path of practice, or the education or process, if you like, is to be developed. So you have four duties, four kinds of practice: understanding or comprehending, abandoning, realizing, and developing. So notice that first one, if we, just for the sake of argument, we use this word suffering, it's the Buddha's teaching us to transcend suffering through understanding of it. So it's not that we're saying we don't want suffering, we're going to turn our back on suffering, because you can't do that. The only way you can be free from suffering is comprehending it. So we say, yes, suffering, if you're wise, you can make use of suffering and pain and difficulties in life. But, you know, you can also learn and grow and flourish through pleasant experiences. There's no reason that the unpleasant is in itself, you know, something to be treasured and something to hold on to. I mean, I don't think even Christians would say they actually seek out suffering, or they particularly want it. But, so again, you know, it's a difference, it's a whole different worldview, really. There are so many ways of distorting. Remember that. I don't know what the nickname for him was. Jeffrey Dahmer, this American guy who caught people and took them home and cut them up and ate them and had bits of them all hanging around his room on lines in the fridge. And did you ever hear about this guy? One of these kind of horrible, frightening mass murderers. But at his trial, he said, you know, he did it for religious purpose because. Jesus loved him, and he wanted to prove to people that he could do even such horrible things as he did, and he was still loved by Jesus. Therefore, you know, it was a teaching to everyone. The possibility of distorting religious teachings and using them as excuses for doing what you want to do is unlimited. You like it, man? I'm not going to be able to hear you, I don't think. Would you like to come up here and use the microphone? Is that... Yeah? Can you take the mic?
Yesterday you taught us about jetana, and then you taught us that if our intentions were good, then we shouldn't be responsible for feeling guilty about things. But I think growing up, you know, we've experienced some of the things that we're not sure if it's right or wrong, even though we're pretty sure ourselves that, you know, we mean well and we have good intentions. An everyday example is this, for example, if you have an argument with your parents, but your intentions is good. Growing up, you make lots of decisions, for example, decisions regarding your career, and you have good intentions that eventually the ultimate goal is to please your parents, but in the short term, you end up, you're silenced in order to avoid conflicts, or your own methods in order to avoid conflicts might hurt them in the short term. So you might give them discomfort, you might make them feel uneasy in the short term. In the long term, your intentions mean well. Would that make you guilty, or would that make you wrong if in the short term you are actually causing pain for your loved ones or people around you, but in the long term, it's for the good.
The whole concept of it's important to recognize the whole concept of guilt. It's a Western cultural construct. You know that it's not something that's kind of inherent in human beings. This is part of the problem about going to the West. You pick up these kinds of illnesses without quite realizing it. In anthropology, one of the traditional ways of talking about cultures like Thailand, comparing it, at least traditionally, and comparing it with Western cultures, is that the Western cultures are what we call guilt cultures, and Thailand is an example of a shame culture. But with the growing influence of Western ideas and many people going and living in the West for a long time, this sort of the guilt culture is starting to spread into Thailand. So there is a difference between guilt and shame. And here, even to use the word shame is difficult because, again, it takes on kind of Christian connotations. But the word kwam la'ai in Thai is not the same as I. Kwam la'ai. And it's based on wise reflection. An understanding when you see a conflict between your ideals and your conduct. So if you have a clear idea of what is appropriate to you as a human being, or as a good daughter, or a good son, or a parent, or a brother, or a sister, or a Buddhist, or a subject of the king, or whatever. This, you have a clear idea of what that means to you, and you commit yourself to that, but then for one reason or another you act contrary to that. Then you have a feeling of shame. It's a feeling of conflict between your ideal, what you aspire to, and how you actually behave. So the extent to which you have a wise understanding of what it means to be a mother, a father, a sister, a brother, a son, a daughter, a Buddhist, or whatever, the clearer those concepts are to you, and the more intelligent those concepts are defined, then the more useful to you will be this emotion of shame, or kwam la'ai. Now, I would contrast this to guilt. Now, guilt is based on a basic misunderstanding. It's like it's all bound up very much with the sense of self, who you are, and this idea that at a certain time in the past, you should have been somebody else. You shouldn't have been like that. And so this whole thing of should and shouldn't. And this is where you create so much unnecessary suffering for yourself. You say, oh, when I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have been like that. But if you look at it more closely, you see, well, at that particular time, in that particular year, that particular day, you were like that. That's who you were. And the causes and conditions that were prevalent on that day were just like that. To say that you shouldn't have been like that means it, to say that you shouldn't be who you are, which is, you know, obviously ridiculous. So the it's very important to learn how to have loving kindness or metta for yourself, and also to forgive yourself for mistakes you've made. I mean, I don't think there's anybody here who hasn't made mistakes in their life. And you're going to make mistakes because you're not perfect, you're not arahants, you have defilements. And it's seeing this that can actually give you some inspiration and some interest to really work upon yourself and to try to eradicate these defilements. Because when we do act in ways which cause ourselves pain or others pain, it's not because of some sort of intrinsic essence of who I am, that kind of bad person. It means that at that particular time, then some defilement or other had taken over your mind. It's like your temporary insanity, if you like. When we have certain ideals and commit ourselves to them, let's say we have a sense of katanyu for parents, and that we want to repay in some way and show our appreciation of their kindness and all they've done for us, then that's a very wholesome emotion and something to be cultivated. It's a sign of a civilized person. But at the same time, you have to have the wisdom faculty to recognize that it doesn't mean that you make your parents happy in every single matter, because it can be quite common that parents have wrong views, or parents are deluded. I mean, because parents love us and have done all kinds of things for us, it doesn't mean that they don't make mistakes either. So let's say a very simple example. Say your parents like to go to the casino, and they say, we want you to go along with us, keep us company. We want to teach you how to gamble. You know, and so, you know, what do you do? Does that mean that if you're a good son or daughter that you should go along. Or your parents are very heavy drinkers. Or your parents are drug addicts and they want to get you addicted as well. I mean, does it mean if you're a good son or a daughter you should do everything that your parents tell you? Or does it mean should you never disappoint them or never do anything that they don't want you to do? I don't think that's the case. Just the same as if you're a parent, it doesn't mean if you love your kids you give them everything they want. So you have to have a higher authority, and it doesn't mean also you just do what you want to do. I'm my own, you know, I've got my own ideas about things. Sort of very kind of Western individualist kind of idea. But it means that, for me, I think that the highest bun kun that we recognize is bun kun of the Buddha. And so that's like a fixed, absolutely, for me, dependable standard. And that gives a perspective on relations with parents. So, you know, if a parent says, let's go to the casino, let's go and get drunk, you say, well, you know, I don't want to offend your parents. You try and find a way out of it. But in the end, you know, the Buddha is like on a higher level of bun kun than parents. And then you've been born, in my understanding, so many millions of times. You know, you have parents for this lifetime, and you've probably had close relationship with them in one way or another over many past lifetimes. That's why you were born as their children. But it doesn't necessarily mean that their desires, their views, their needs must come first in this present life. You have to have a higher refuge than parents. Certainly some things we do that, you know, we have to make a decision and take responsibility for it. So in Buddhist ethics, it's not that kind of, you should do this, don't do that, you know, if you do that, you're going to hell or something like that. But what we're teaching is develop your mind, develop your sensitivity, your sense of responsibility, so you are able to make intelligent choices. So the idea is learning how to become mature enough to make good decisions. That's what Buddhism's teaching. Rather than saying, in this case you should do this, in that case you should do that, you should always be like this, you should never be like that. There are so many different causes and conditions and variables and things that are coming into play that you can't just have a handbook for life, can you? You know, or a sort of a book that tells you what to do. But you do can develop that confidence that if you're mindful and you're able to put down feelings of anger, disappointment, noijai or whatever, that when your mind is calm and clear, you make good decisions. And you notice that when you're just full of so much resentment and feeling of injustice, it's not right, it's not fair, why is it like to be like that? You don't make good decisions when your mind is in that state. So this is your refuge, the sense of bringing your mind to that sense of calmness and clarity and mindfulness that you can weigh things up clearly. And you look in the past and you say, yeah, even with the best of intentions, I made a mistake. And you forgive yourself for that. Well, yeah, that's what people do. That's what we do. We make mistakes. But how can I learn from that and not do it in the future? But I think to live in the world, to live in a monastery and not to unintentionally hurt people sometimes is impossible. To think that you can sort of control your situation, control the people around you, control things so that, you know, it's like this sort of cotton wool environment where everything's nice and, you know, and this is a kind of a false harmony. You know, there are different kinds of harmony, like samakhi is very important in a family, in workplace, wherever. But sometimes you pay too high a price for it, and it's a forced kind of harmony. So, like the true kind of harmony is we have in the monastic order something we call pawarana, and that means that all the monks make an invitation to all the other monks. You say, you trust your friends, your fellow monks. You say, look, if you see me doing or saying anything which is inappropriate or is, you know, please, I give you invitation, please tell me, I'd like to know. I want to see this, and I've got blind spots. I want to be free of them. Some things I can't see, you can see, please tell me. And so you have this real sense of harmony where everyone's open with each other, trust each other, that someone tells you something, it's not because they want to prove that they're better than you or to put you down, but because you've given them the opportunity, you've given them that sincere invitation, and they're taking you up on it. So you develop a very kind of it's kind of a tough harmony in the sense that, you know, you're not telling lies to each other, but you're not just sort of blurting out things, you know, I hate you, you know. But the kind of the forced kind of harmony, and it's one that's very common, you know, I see in Thailand, in monasteries as well, this kind of thing. It's like, look, you don't tell me what's wrong with me, and I won't tell you what's wrong with you, okay? You know, I'll turn a blind eye to everything you do wrong, as long as you don't say anything about what I do wrong. And yeah, this is a kind of very common kind of harmony that people have. So you develop this kind of, you know, you're always sort of tiptoeing around things, you know, certain issues, certain people, certain things. Yeah, you don't go too close, it's touchy, you know. So yeah, you don't have any real arguments, you don't shout at each other, you don't walk out and bang the doors and scream and so on. So it's quite peaceful, but it is something that's inauthentic. It's not really true and sincere. So I think that in a mature relationship, there does have to be a certain amount of disagreement. I mean, it's how can people of different generations, different backgrounds, how can you see agree on everything? It's not possible. But the idea is to have a relationship which is strong enough to be able to take that on board. Yeah, say, yeah, we love each other, but we have arguments sometimes. We don't agree about everything, you know. And sometimes, you know, something I do, a person in the family, a parent even, doesn't agree with it. But you have that kind of trust. I hope that they have that, you know, trust in you or in me, that they know that I'm doing it from, you know, as I see things, with the most sincere way that I can. But to have to think, you have only do things that, you know, your parents will agree with all the time. I mean, I speak as a like Phat Pharang, and so many of the Western monks, of course, and it's quite a big thing, certainly 20, 30 years ago, for my generation to leave home and go all the way to Thailand to become a Buddhist monk. And some of the monks, their parents just cut them off altogether, wouldn't have anything to do with them anymore, which is very painful. Other parents just kind of put up with it. One of my friends, he got a telegram that his mother had a heart attack, and he got on the next plane back to England, and it was a lie. It was just a trick to get him to go home. But generally speaking, after that kind of initial kind of shock and difficulty, parents see their sons as monks, and they like it. Yeah, I mean, it's mothers tend to like it, you see, because if you're a mother, you know, you're attached to your son, and then suddenly your son gets a girlfriend or gets married, and from being the number one woman in your son's life, you're number two. But you see, if your son becomes a monk, you're number one woman for your son for the rest of his life, you see. So it's quite an attractive option for some women. You know?
Yesterday you mentioned that there are different types of Buddhist teachings, such as Tibetan, Theravada, Mahayana. So I was wondering, do you think there is one most effective one, and do they all have the same goal? And maybe why did you choose Theravada teachings in Thailand rather than the other ones?
Well, I think it's it's noticeable, and I'm very happy and kind of proud of the fact that although there are different schools of Buddhism, different, as you say, Tibetan, Mahayana, Tantrayana, and so on, that we all get on very well, and there's no kind of competition or bad feeling between different schools. I think, of course, up to quite recently, you didn't have a choice. You know, like if you're Thai, you become Theravada Buddhist. If you're Tibetan, you become a Tibetan Buddhist. Of course, now we're in this sort of globalization where you can pick and choose. And it's like they call it the spiritual supermarket. Which, you know, and so in the States, you know, sometimes you get people who've, you know, go along to the monasteries and they've done Zen retreats and they've done Tibetan retreats and they've done yoga and they've done this and they've done everything you've ever heard of, you know, and they never commit themselves to anything, you know, just become this kind of dilettante kind of picking and choosing, or you pick those things that, you know, sort of don't threaten your, you know, don't take you out of your safety zone in that kind of thing. But I think that myself, different schools attract different personalities, and so I think that's, you know, you can choose something that really kind of suits you, your personality. It's a matter of not just sort of this and then that, but choosing something and sticking with it. For instance, you can observe in Europe, for instance, that Northern Europe tends to be Theravadin, Southern Europe tends to be Tibetan. It seems like the more, like the Mediterranean Catholic cultures, they have a real affinity with Tibetan, whereas the sort of the more Protestant Northern European cultures, they tend to like the sort of straight Theravada more. The Tibetan is it's very much more colourful and exotic and kind of strange, and, you know, it's kind of exciting, you know, whereas Theravada is kind of boring. It's the most boring form of Buddhism. Yes, but I mean, it's particularly because it's so kind of boring and plain that I like it. Yeah. I think I also, when I was first, when the first year or two, I tried all kinds of things as well. I liked Theravada for a number of reasons. I liked the meditation techniques, and I had a lot of confidence in the, you know, these were the original teachings of the Buddha. But one thing is that in the Tibetan tradition and some of the Mahayana traditions, they have this idea that once someone's enlightened, then they don't have to keep all the... you can't expect an enlightened person to be moral in the same way that an ordinary person is. They've gone beyond this. And I don't know if any of you have heard of, the most classic example of this is Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche is one of the great figures of modern Tibetan Buddhism. He was recognized as a Rinpoche, which means like a great teacher reborn, as a boy in Tibet, and went to Oxford University. He's one of some incredible, brilliant intellectually, spoke English superbly, went to America, and created his own organization there, and attracted most of his Luksits were like had university degrees, doctorates, attracted very brilliant people, and it became a very powerful organization. But his personal life, you know, so many women, and the thing was, he's a really heavy drinker, and when he give talks, he wouldn't have like water here, he'd have whiskey. I used to have a tape in my kuti, and it's like an hour talk on the Four Noble Truths, and side A is like really clear, incredible articulation, very, very good, and this side B sort of just, you know, and it's almost unintelligible. And he'd do these incredible things like go and give a talk at Harvard and walk in about half an hour late and sort of so say, and then just fall asleep on the podium for half an hour, you know, this is, and then people like that, you know, wow, you know, this is cool, you know, so, it's kind of fun, but I have difficulty in sort of committing myself to a system of training in which you have this idea that people of a certain level of attainment
don't have to follow the same kinds of rules as everyone else. It seems to me that the opportunity for deluded teachers and deluded pupils is always there, and that the opportunity for corruption and so on. And this is exactly what happened in this organization. Eventually, he died of cirrhosis of the liver, eventually, although that's not generally spoken about. But at the same time, at his funeral, all kinds of incredible things happened, like the clouds formed into like a form of a dragon. And there's photographs of this. He's a special kind. He's not just an ordinary person. Okay, but he chose his Dhamma successor, who was this kind of also very brilliant man, American man. So I can't remember his name, Özal Sensin. And this is in the 80s. And after taking over the organization and running it for a while, it turns out that he had AIDS, and knowing that he had AIDS, head of a spiritual, he'd had sex both with his male and female disciples, and infected. And this was this is before your time. But this is one of the major kind of scandals in American Buddhist history in the 20th century. And you can imagine what that did to the whole thing, So, and it's painful for us as Theravada Buddhists, where, people just say Buddhism, and they think that's, somehow you're involved with that because you're a Buddhist. In the Buddhist monastic, in the Theravada monastic order, there's certain things I just liked immediately. Like, for instance, I've been a monk now for nearly 30 years, but I dress in exactly the same way that I did when I was a novice or a monk. I have an extra robe because I'm a monk. But some cotton robes, exactly the same. Don't have a special hat because I'm a sort of big teacher. Don't have sort of brocade and gold and a gold walking stick or something like this, it's a very important principle in monastic order that no matter how senior you are and how attained you are, how enlightened you are, you have to keep every single rule that a newly ordained monk keeps. So even if you don't have any defilements left, you've got no greed, no hatred, no delusion, your mind's completely pure, you still have to behave as if your mind was full of defilements. You refrain from all the same things and live in the same way. So what that means is, as a young student, whether a monastic student or a lay student, you have a great deal of security there. You know that you're not going to be taken advantage of, because the guidelines and the veneer of the monk is absolutely clear cut, and there's no way that you can get round that. So I think that it provides, as a terms of a system, and something that can provide a dependable and trustworthy vehicle for people to learn about Buddhism. Yeah, I like this form. Anybody else for something? Oh, okay.
Can you explain the benefit of chanting? Because most of the time, I've had a lot of occasions where I've been chanting Pali words, and like since I was young, I had sort of Tinaban chant before I go to bed every night, but I've never known what it means. Is there any benefit to kind of reciting these words where you have no idea what they mean?
Yeah, well, although Pali is what we call a dead language in that, nobody uses it these days, there are translations for all the Pali words that are available. So, you know, if you don't understand the words, it's, you know, it's because you haven't ever bothered to look up the meanings. I mean, it's not like you have to live in ignorance of the meanings. I think that Pali chanting, if you give to us, is a very soothing and pleasant meditation exercise, and just keeping your mind on the words, and just if just on the sounds themselves. But if you, as I say, if you do just pick up a book with the translation on it and just check it with the translation, so that you do know what it means, then it becomes even more profound. But I did make the point on the first evening that chanting is not like a, you know, a sort of a necessary or fundamental part of spiritual development, but it's something that many people enjoy and find useful. And so, you know, it really depends on you. If you find it's just you just don't like chanting and it doesn't really helpful, I don't think it's, you know, it's to say you should do it as a kind of a sense, out of sense of duty. But if you can find a way of enjoying it, and I like to come, you see, my Buddha image here, I come every morning before Bindabat and chant by myself, and I just get so much enjoyment out of that. Because I know what the words mean, and I have that sense of faith and confidence in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, so it's very meaningful to me. So it's a matter of, you know, willing to make that commitment to learn what the words mean and to see if it brings up some very positive feelings and emotions. Because particularly in the Western world now, that sort of the first kind of wave of Buddhism was translation. Second wave was kind of study. And it's very, especially in England and Europe, very kind of intellectual, especially the Theravada Buddhism. And it kind of like completely threw out all the kind of devotional practices. And this was partly because most people came from Christianity, and we said we don't want to do all that kind of hymns and all that kind of stuff. We want Buddhism. It's like really profound. And, but, you know, the an all-round kind of education or spiritual education is one in which you have to be educating and nourishing both the intellectual side and the emotional side. And these kinds of bowing and chanting, they're practices that, you know, you're not learning anything in terms of information, you know, you're not gaining information about anything, but it's very emotionally uplifting. And it gives that kind of emotional and power and energy, which then can be used in other areas of spiritual life. Another point I made on the first evening was that, you know, in terms of living in communities, monastic communities, or it's just a very, very good thing to create harmony in the group, to chant together. You know, it gives that. If you're in a monastery and all the monks are off in their kuttis or meditating all day, to come together once or twice a day and all chant together, it's a kind of very good good feeling for a group, and to do something all together. So leoleng pasabali pasabali mi kamplae tuk kam le ta rao mai khao chai kwam mai tong pe ha nang sue ti plae pali pen thai mi nang sue yeat yeat le แต่ถึงจะไม่เข้าใจการสวดปาลีด้วยจิตใจที่อยู่ในปัจจุบันก็ทำให้จิตใจสงบกับการกำหนดเสียงของปาลี เป็นการฝึกจิตให้สงบในระดับสูงขึ้นไปในการปฏิบัติธรรมบางการศึกษาและการปฏิบัติบางประการต้องใช้สมองต้องใช้ความคิดการพิจารณาในขณะเดียวกันก็ต้องการสิ่งที่จะบำรุงจิตใจบำรุงความรู้สึกให้งดงามแล้วการทำวัดสวดมนต์ก็มีส่วนในการบำรุงความรู้สึกหรือ emotion ได้ผลของการปฏิบัติอีกข้อหนึ่งคือถ้าเราปฏิบัติเอาจริงเอาจังหน่อยมันก็ถึงขั้นที่เรา เริ่มจะซาบซึ้งในหลักธรรมมากขึ้นเรื่องว่าพระพุทธคืออะไรพระธรรมคืออะไรพระสงฆ์คืออะไรแล้วกว่ามันจะเกิดจิตใจมันเปลี่ยนนะฮะแบบก็จะมีความสุขในการกราบแทนที่เห็นว่ากราบเหมือนก็เป็นการบริหารกายอะไรเงี้ยมันก็เรียกว่าสักแต่ว่ากราบเพราะว่าคนอื่นกราบหรือว่าผู้ใหญ่ให้กราบมันจะมีความสุขในการกราบมากคือจะซาบซึ้งในความหมายของการกราบแล้วความในคำหมายของความหมายของบทสวดมนต์ต่างๆแม้จนกระทั่งนโมตัสสะอะไรเราก็จะซาบซึ้งทีนี้ก็จะเป็นสิ่งที่ค่อยๆเกิดขึ้นโดยการประพฤติปฏิบัติ
I have to ask in English because it would make sense in Thai Coming back to what you said earlier this morning about reincarnation or good what is it rebirth I was thinking that the soul or the thing which we couldn't define what it isI was thinking about it. It could be the memory, because, well, to my understanding, our mental activity consists of electrical pulses, right? And if you have electrical pulses, you have some kind of a force field. And since, say, the people that can remember past lives, such as the soldiers, they may not be aware, and say the fields are still active when they die, and then they get this active field floating in the air.Or whatever, and so children who are young, they can remember things like, oh, they were soldiers of some sort, did not recognize the fact that they were going to die before they did. So that kind of field is still active. That's one condition. And the second condition is that the monks who have trained the force so well can control that force. So when they come to the next life, they can remember.You know what they were before. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean that. You know, it's speculation, isn't it? I mean, I don't agree, and I don't think that you can find any experimental evidence to support that idea. So, I mean, you know, you'd have to be able to show me some data and some evidence to back that up.I mean, rather than, you know, just say, does it sound possible, you know? I'm quite happy with the explanations I've been given by people who are much wiser than I am. You know, there is a certain amount of faith and confidence involved. The materialist views that dominated Western discourse throughout most of the 20th century, sort of materialist consensus is now falling apart, and there's a great deal of disagreement. But one of the big, hot topics in science these days is neuroplasticity. I don't know if anyone has heard of neuroplasticity. And what this basically means is that whereas formerly they believed that once you were born, you know, your brain is your brain and that your mind is a kind of a byproduct of all the chemicals and the force fields and everything in your brain somehow. They can't explain exactly how, but somehow there's this connection between sort of chemicals and synapses and all this kind of stuff and the mind. So the brain is the main thing.And this is why there's this refusal to listen really to the evidence supporting rebirth because it cuts against this belief that the brain is the basis, the material phenomena are the basis and the mind is secondary. But what they found since the advances of technology with MRI and so on is that now they find that our brains...are plastic, which means not that they're made of plastic, but that they have this ability to change. So if you, for instance, learn a musical instrument, then a certain part of your brain changes. It's different from someone who doesn't know how to play that musical instrument. Certain passages and all these kind of brain things, you know. I don't know all the language, but...
the idea being that it changes. And similarly, if you meditate a lot, your brain activity is measurably different from someone who doesn't meditate. You stimulate certain parts of the brain which are not generally stimulated. And so, I mean, brain science is very primitive, really, but they can say, you know, this, you know, so this area here or somewhere, you know, if someone's happy, then there's usually high activity here. So they got these people meditating, and they say, oh, yeah, this sort of the happiness area lights up in all these people. So they say, yeah, yes, this is the proof that people who meditate are happier than people who don't. This is, so, you know, then people can believe it because the scientist says it rather than a monk. But, but the point being that the mind is creating the brain, you know, much more than the brain is creating the mind. And this is why there is this possibility of making radical changes in consciousness, because it's not just a matter of chemicals.
มีคำถามภาษาไทยขอกราบเรียนถามขณะนี้ในโลกนี้พระอรหันต์มีพระอรหันต์หลายองค์ไหมมาขึ้นเริ่มหน่อยกว่าแต่ก่อนรู้ได้อย่างไรว่าองค์ไหนอรหันต์แล้วแน่นอนคนทั่วไปดูไม่ออกมันไม่มีเครื่องบอกบางทีคือบางคนก็จะเอาความผ่องใสเป็นหลักโอ้คนผ่องใสมากแต่คนบ้านี่ผ่องใสมีนะใช่ฮะบางคนบ้าบางคนนะผ่องใสมากและพวกที่ความเชื่อก็ทำให้คนผ่องใสได้บางทีคนที่เชื่ออะไรมากๆพวกที่จะปลีชีพเนี่ยพวกอิสระก่อนนี่โอ้เขาผ่องใสมากเขาเชื่อว่าเขากำลังจะไปสวรรค์แต่เราดูข้างนอกไม่ได้แล้วอีกคนหนึ่งแม้แต่ผู้ปฏิบัติเองนะหลอกตัวเองได้แม้แต่ในสมัยพุทธกาลก็ยังมีพระหลายรูปที่เชื่อว่าตัวเองเป็นพระอรหันต์ที่จริงไม่ใช่แล้วฉะนั้นในหมู่พระวัดป่าเนี่ยเราก็จะมีธรรมเนียมว่าถ้าองค์ไหนปฏิบัติดีปฏิบัติชอบเชื่อว่าได้แล้วต้องไปหาผู้ใหญ่ที่เป็นที่ยอมรับว่าใช่แล้วให้ท่านดูคือพระบางองค์พระระดับในบางองค์ท่านก็ดูจิตใจของคนเราเหมือนเอ็กซเรย์เลยท่านจะดูมันจะมีแสงมันแสงระดับนี้เป็นยังไงแสงนี้ท่านจะมีเนี่ยท่านก็ดูเราออกเหมือนเอ็กซเรย์เลยว่าเราเป็นอย่างไรแต่บางแต่ท่านจะพูดถึงจำนวนพูดไม่ได้อาตมาไม่ทราบเลยจะมากน้อยลงเนี่ยพูดยากถ้าคือถ้ามองในความเปลี่ยนแปลงของชีวิตคนสุดทุกวันนี้วุ่นวายแต่ก่อนก็น่าจะเป็นเหตุได้น้อยลงถ้าในขณะเดียวกันถ้าคิดเป็นเปอร์เซ็นต์คือร้อยกว่าปีที่แล้วสมัยหลวงปู่มั่นคนไทยมีเท่าไหร่สัก5ล้านใช่ไหมทีนี้60กว่าล้านแล้วถ้าคิดเปอร์เซ็นต์เนี่ยมันก็น่าจะมีมากขึ้นใช่ไหมก็ไม่แน่นอนมีพระเล่าในคัมภีร์ว่ามีพระอาจารย์องค์หนึ่งที่ท่านเชื่อว่าท่านเป็นพระอรหันต์แต่ท่านมีลูกศิษย์ลูกหาเยอะมากในวันใดวันหนึ่งลูกศิษย์ของท่านองค์หนึ่งภาวนาตอนกลางคืนปัญลุเป็นอรหันต์พอท่านปัญลุเป็นอรหันต์ท่านก็เกิดญาณรู้วารจิตของคนอื่นทั้งหมดท่านก็น้อมจิตไปสู่อาจารย์เหมือนก็จะโทรจิต ไปถึงอาจารย์ไปบอกข่าวปรากฏว่าอาจารย์ไม่ใช่อรหันต์เลยยังไม่บรรลุจริงท่านหลงตัวเองเพียงแต่ว่าสมาธิท่านดีๆคือถ้าจิตใจสมาธิดีเนี่ยมันจะคล้ายกับหลุดพ้นคือจิตใจก็จะสบายตลอดคือไม่ค่อยจะอยากได้อะไรไม่ค่อยจะโกรธจะงุนงิดมันรู้สึกสบายสบายอันนี้ก็คือผลของสมาธิแต่ไม่เกิดปัญญาแท้จริงทำให้คนลงได้ทีนี้ลูกศิษย์ก็ลำบากใจเดี๋ยวจะปล่อยอาจารย์มันไม่ถูกเดี๋ยวก็อยากจะช่วยอาจารย์แต่เราจะไปสอนอาจารย์แล้วบอกว่าอาจารย์เนี่ยท่านอาจารย์ไม่ใช่หรอกผมนี่แหละเป็นอรหันต์ก็พูดยากใช่ไหมเกรงใจทำยังไงดีเนี่ยท่านเลยไปกราบท่านอาจารย์ไปนั่งคุยแล้วท่านก็มีวิธีคือท่านมีความสามารถพิเศษสามารถจะทำถ้าสมัยใหม่หรือว่าโฮโลแกรมคล้ายๆอย่างนั้นแต่ใช้พลังจิตสร้างโฮโลแกรมก็นั่งคุยกันดีๆแล้วทำเรียกว่าเหมือนกับเป็นโฮโลแกรมของช้างตกมันกำลังจะวิ่งไปเหยียบพออาจารย์หันไปเห็นช้างตกมันกำลังวิ่งมาเกิดกลัวขึ้นมาแค่เกิดกลัวหนึ่งวินาทีก็รู้ว่าไม่ใช่อรหันต์นี่คืออุบายคือต้องเห็นเองว่าแต่มีเหตุการณ์เกิดขึ้นโดยไม่คาดคิดจะเกิดได้แล้วจะเห็นความจริงของจิตใจแต่อาจารย์ก็เลยโอ้สละสังเวชเศร้าก็เลยนิมนต์ลูกศิษย์กลับกุฏิท่านจะไปภาวนาแล้วก็ท่านก็ไปนั่งสมาธิเดินจงกรมและก่อนวันรุ่งขึ้นท่านก็บรรลุเป็นพระอรหันต์และ lived happily ever after ท่านถามว่าหมาบรรลุทำได้ไหมครับโอเคพวกกราบWe grab the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha. So the Buddha is the our great teacher, person who has found the truth and shared the truth with others. The Dhamma is his teachings. The Sangha, his enlightened disciple. So that's one level of Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Then there's a higher level, if you like.And that is, you take the qualities of the Buddha, qualities of the Buddha being wisdom, compassion, purity. And then the Dhamma means the truth. And the Sangha means that committed search for the truth, like patibatti, patibatchok. So grabbing, when you grab, it means like we have very little wisdom,very little compassion, very little purity, I grab the perfection of wisdom, purity and compassion. You humble yourself before, it's a reminder of yourself of what you consider the highest thing, what you aspire to in life. I myself who's deluded and doesn't see very clearly, I bow to the truth. Then I bow to the practice, the commitment to pure practice to realize the truth is the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So if you bow like that, it's a way of like just starting again, reminding yourself, you know, what your spiritual aspirations are. What is it that you hold to be the highest? And there is a special feeling that arises when you bring your forehead down to the ground. You know, and you, if you bring your forehead onto the ground, there's something. There's a very special kind of feeling.And that sense of humbling yourself before your ideals, and I think if you really understand it, can bring up a lot of piti. I've often told this story many years ago now.
almost 20 years, I spent a whole year in a cave in Ganchanaburi. And it was, you have to climb up like a cliff, and then you crawl into this cave, and then inside it's absolutely black. You can't even see your own hand. And I stayed in that cave for 1 year, and I didn't go out, and people brought me food, and I was meditating in this cave. So even with that kind of situation, your mind goes up and down. And I had this period where I just got very sort of lost all my kind of inspiration, kind of low and no energy. And I was really asking myself, what's going on here? And I reflected on a Buddhist teaching of what we call the five powers. It was one is like satta, faith, then viriya, effort, sati, mindfulness, samadhi, concentration, panya, wisdom. So if viriya, the second one, is weak, it means that its supporting condition, the first one, must be weak, like the satta. So what can I do to bring up a sense of satta? So I lit a candle. So I lit a candle and I bowed three times to the Buddha, Dhamma Sangha. Then I bowed to Prasariputta, and I bowed to Pramahamokkhala, and then to Pra-Anon, and then to Pra-Anurudh, and to all the great monks in the time of the Buddha. And then I just kept bowing and bowing and bowing, for hundreds of times, to all the great teachers I could think of, all the way down to my own teachers and the great monks in Thailand and fellow monks who helped me, and bowing for hundreds of times, and just brought up so much kind of joy and happiness. And I found that all that energy just came back. So really saw the value of bowing as a practice. If any of you ever been to Buddh Gaya, to Buddh Gaya, and you've seen the Tibetan monks and nuns doing prostrations there, has anybody seen? Everybody been to Buddh Gaya? Ti Dasaru Puttaja, maybe Kai Pai. Yeah. Na Song San. When you start off, you're accepted by a Tibetan Ajahn as your Luksit. He gives you these what they call preliminary practices, and one of them is to do 100,000 prostrations. So and that's standing and then going. Have you seen it go right down onto Tibetan prostration? Who's going to do a Tibetan prostration as an example here? You come out like that, and then you go like that, and then you go right down onto the ground, like full flat on the ground, and then stand up. It's quite intense physically. If you're doing it in India or in hot country, and so most people try to do maybe like 1,000 a day, and it's so like an hour in the morning, an hour in the afternoon, something, and it takes a few months to do it. And most people get ill during it because it sort of brings up all these kind of impurities in your body. But so bowing is a very important part of the Tibetan practice. This evening, we're after the meeting. I think probably we've got some Dhamma songs. It's going to be like a singing period. And a couple of these songs are composed by an American monk called Venerable Hung Shaw, who these days lives in Berkeley, California. And he ordained, he became a monk in the Chinese tradition in California, and was a disciple of Venerable Master Hua, who's one of the great modern Chinese masters, who's now passed away. And they had a temple in China. They had a they had a temple in Chinatown in LA, and they got a new property in Ukiah, which is about 200 kilometers north of San Francisco. And so he did this traditional Chinese practice of going Tudong from Los Angeles to Northern California, which is over 1,000 kilometers. But his way of walking was he walked three steps and then he did a bow, and walked three steps and bowed all the way along the road from LA to Northern California. It was an incredible journey. And you can imagine going through California, some of the small towns, and people throwing beer cans at him, and some people gave some like magic mushrooms to him to eat. And but other people stopped and offered food and bowed and asked for teachings, and so many experiences. But it's an incredible thing to do. The other thing, if you there are certain times in Bodh Gaya in India when the Dalai Lama goes to give talks, and there are people who've come from Tibet and they've done that all the way from Tibet even. It's very austere kind of practice. Well, it's about time. It's time for one more question, if anybody. Very last question. Anybody got anything? Do you want to ask something? Well, if there's no more questions, then we can end the session.